This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Doucet Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Enjoy the show.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Canoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Political developments on multiple fronts this week, starting with continuing fallout from Congressman Frank Gintis' troubles with the Federal Election Commission. Despite mounting pressure to resign, including from within his own party, Gintis said he's ready to move on.
I feel that once all of the questions are answered, we can put this matter behind us. The settlement is behind me. And I can continue in focusing on what people elected me to do.
Gintis spoke on NH1 News. Meanwhile, at the State House, the Senate, with the help of updated revenue estimates, has restored funding for social service programs cut by the House. Senate Finance Chair Jeanie Forster said it was a matter of compassion.
We set our priorities, and our priorities were very clear. We're going to take care of our vulnerable citizens. We're going to take care of Meals on Wheels, Service Link, the DD community. And that's what we did.
And in presidential politics, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush visited Bedford this week, where he told voters he's not afraid of a fight, using as an example his attempt to reform public education as governor.
I was all in. I never let up. I fought these people all the way through, whether it's the bureaucrats or the teachers union, and that's what we need in Washington, D.C.
It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the roundup this week, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. And Gary, welcome back. Good to see you.
Oh, good to be here, Laura.
And also with us, Kathleen Ronayne. She's New Hampshire State House and Politics reporter with the Associated Press. And Kathleen, welcome back.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thanks as always.
Good morning, Laura.
Well, and Dean, let's start with the big political story surrounding New Hampshire. Frank Ginta, this week, the first district congressman, basically said he's moving on after his troubles with the Federal Election Commission. But a fair number of top party officials here in the Granite State are urging him to resign. Who is saying that, Dean, and why?
Yeah, well, we had this remarkable moment last week where it started to feel as though there was this real momentum building for getting Congressman Ginta to resign. You had Republican Senator Kelly Ayotte, who's essentially the senior elected official for Republicans in the state, calling for him to step down. Senate President Chuck Morse, House Speaker Sean Jasper, so key Republican leaders in the state saying he should step down. The union leader was extremely critical of him. They had the Joe McQuaid had the one line editorial that said Frank Ginta's a damn liar, and so it was just a sort of moment where it was really building. And then that evening, when this was all occurring last week or earlier in the week, state Republican Party's executive committee decided not to ask for his resignation. So it almost threw him a lifeline, essentially, saying they talked to him for a half hour and we're not going to ask for him to step down at that point. And, you know, it's all about the, you know, was he truthful about the source of the money? Did he really break the FEC rules? He signed this agreement and said he did. It was a very close primary election in 2010. So some are even suggesting that, you know, that really made the difference for him. So, you know, there's all this pressure building. He has He has hung in there. When it first broke, you know, he essentially said to the union leader and to WMUR that, you know, I have the documents. I can show you that this money was my own. My sense from talking to people of both of those outlets is that the information he provided did not sufficiently prove that the money was his. They were not convinced. So this is an ongoing story. He's hanging in there right now. You know, the big question is, you know, I think some Republicans are thinking if they were to have a special election now, Republicans would have a better chance of holding onto that seat than if they wait to 2016, where he'll be challenged, you know, very strongly in a primary. And we know that in presidential years, Democratic turnout tends to be higher. So maybe
see.
A little
so
tougher to hold on. I think there's a strategic rationale.
Yeah.
In addition to all the other stuff about whether or not he was honest with people, I think there's a legitimate strategic rationale for getting him out now rather than trying to hold the seat in 2016.
Okay, Gary.
You also think, though, I mean, you could look at it the other way. I mean, having a special election now, you're going to probably have somebody with large name recognition like Carol Shea Porter in there, and may they even be more likely to lose the seat.
Possible, sure. I mean, it depends on when the special election is called and you know, who comes, you know, who challenges. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, I that's what I thought. I thought when they said that they were going to take a pass.
Yeah, I think it's going to be
tough
in 2016.
That they were more looking like they were going to just say, maybe we would lose this seat and we don't want to try to put it out there that way.
Well, and again, just the pure political aspect of this, Kathleen Ronayne, what about the disconnect between these very senior party officials, Sean Jasper, you know, Speaker of the House, Chuck Morris, President of the Senate, Jeb Bradley, Majority Leader, you know, all calling for Ginter to resign, but then the party itself saying, nah, it's okay, he can stay. What's with that disconnect there?
Well, I think, you know, none of us know what happened in that room when the executive committee was meeting. If Ginter really dug his heels in and said, there's no way I'm resigning, does it make sense for the party to come out and call for him to resign? I mean, they don't really have any power. They cannot force him to resign. So I think not knowing what happened in that room, it's hard to know if they made the right choice or not. Because if he's made it clear that he is not going to go, then saying he should go only furthers this narrative that the Republican Party is splintered, they can't control their people. You know, we're already seeing that narrative, I think, start to be spun by the Democrats that, you know, the party is divided. I think either way, you know, this is bad for Republicans. And I think that for Ginta, he might try and kind of quietly fly under the radar, you know, for the next year and a half or so, probably mm-hmm. not seek reelection. I mean, I don't know how you could, but it's not just about Frank Gintz anymore. It's about the entire Republican Party. And if he stays on the ticket, you know, it becomes very easy for people to tie – or not stays on the ticket, but going into 2016, it's – you know, they're going to continue to tie Senator Ayotte to him. They're going to continue to tie all the other Republicans to him. They're going to continue to use this as evidence that, you know – the Republic, or try to use it as evidence that the Republican Party, you know, is corrupt and they're not playing by the rules. So I think that, you know, for Ginta, it's okay, I'm just going to kind of, you know, keep collecting my congressional salary, fly under the radar, figure out how to pay this back. But it really starts to affect the whole party, and we're seeing it turn into this narrative about the whole party. And so I don't know. I think either way, they kind of had their hands tied, you know, if they come out for him to resign or they don't. So he's really put everybody in a tricky spot.
I can see the two of you want to jump in as well. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in the exchange. And we'd love to hear from you as we cover some of the top stories of the week, including the fallout from Congressman Frank Ginta's troubles with the Federal Election Commission. Lots of fallout over this week. Later on, we'll also talk about the state Senate and what it is doing with the state budget. So let's hear from you on those stories and more. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Some Facebook comments on Congressman Ginta. James says, what's next from the party of personal responsibility? Pamela says, no, I want Representative Frank Ginta to finish his term in Washington. I just want to let everybody know we have a ton of Facebook comments on this, and I won't be able to read all of them on the air. But I can see you want to jump in, Gary Raynor. Go ahead, and then I have another question for you, Dean. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I think, you know, one of the reasons you saw people like Senate President Chuck Morris and Sean Jasper jumping in. I mean, they're facing a really tough election in 2016 in trying to hold on to the Republican majority in the House and the Senate. And I mean, you don't need this situation carrying on for the next 18 months and painting the whole party with this whole brush that it's only going to hurt them in the long run. And that's why I think they were quick to jump in. Chris Sununu is another one who was quick to jump in.
Yeah, of course, some people are saying, okay, some of these people who are jumping in would like to hold that seat
or
themselves.
Some other seat down, you know, other seat than being part of that election. So, yeah.
Well, some one writer, and I can't remember who this was, but they said this has turned from personal headache to party-wide migraine. So you're touching on that, Gary, the sort of wider implications of this. Here's my question for you, Dean. A poll by NH1 News found that 60% of First District Republicans thought Frank Ginta should stay. So what's the difference between, you know, again, these party leaders who want him to go and regular voters in the First District?
Well, you know, I think that the sort of what's at stake here, I mean, you know, the sort of the average voter not paying as much attention, they kind of a general sense of, you know, sort of how things are going for them in their district, whereas, you know, party elites are thinking in terms of strategy and electoral outcomes, and a lot of them have a kind of a longish history with Frank Ginta, and this has been, you know, for people who are in a position of power in the party and who are dealing with kind of, you know, setting up electoral tickets during elections, this has been going on since 2010. So it's just kind of it's just in a different place. Now, you know, that poll was it said 61% of registered Republicans in CD1, the first congressional district, you know, think he should stay. You know, it's an automated poll. I'm not a big fan of automated polls, and I have not seen the wording of the question. Nonetheless, it kind of puts out there in the public discourse that kind of the average voter thinks it's okay for him to stay. So that, in a way, complicates things even more for elected officials who are trying to decide whether they should come out and call for him to leave now or just hope that he goes quietly in the 2016 election.
You know, last week when we talked about this, we got a couple emails from folks who said, look, you know, we're talking about under $400,000 here in the bigger scheme of things with big interest groups spending billions to win elections. You know, why are we picking on Frank Ginta for $350,000? Kathleen, you want to jump in on there first?
Yeah, I just think that why this story is catching a lot of fire is one, because the deception involved. You know, Frank Ginta has been saying for years and years and years that this money did not come from his parents, that it was just, you know, a mistake on his forms, that this is money that he made himself. You know, parents didn't write the check. And then you find out that, well, the parents did, in fact, write the check. And he's trying to show these documents that prove his innocence. And the union leader saying this doesn't add up. So I think it's because of the, you know, I think for the average voter, caring about the FEC is probably not something that's on their minds. But when it becomes an issue of, you know, deception, that's when it starts to catch on a little bit more. And, you know, I think that there's a point to be made that we have laws in place for a reason. And I know that we all think that the campaign finance system has its flaws, certainly. But I think that, you know, it's really catching on, not necessarily because of the money itself, but because of the cover up.
Yeah. Go ahead, Gary, real quick.
Well, I mean, it's not the money that's the issue. I mean, it's the ethics and the integrity and the trust of the public. I mean, and I think the real issue in whether he stays or he doesn't is how effective a congressman he can be from now on. And I mean, that's really an issue at this point.
All right. Well, coming up, we turn to the state Senate, where the budget is still in play. Senate committees are making lots of changes to what the House did. We'll find out more. So stay with us for more of the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup here on NHPR. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We're covering some of the top stories of the week, and we turn now to the state Senate's work on the budget as it gets ready to vote on its tax and spending plan and then work it out with the House. Join us with your thoughts, questions, comments. The number 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. I'm here with Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, Kathleen Ronanes, New Hampshire State House and politics reporter with the Associated Press, and Dean Spiliotis, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And boy, folks, we could spend a lot of time talking about the Senate budget, but let's hit a couple of the highlights. And Gary Reno, here's the headline that I heard all week. The Senate restores money from the House budget. And senators were kind of patting themselves on the back for being compassionate and, you know, sort of being the good guys in this whole thing. I mean, how are senators able to craft a more generous budget than the House?
Well, I mean, it's always the case. The House is working with numbers that are less developed than the Senate is. The Senate has the advantage of seeing the revenues from March and April, which are two huge months for the state of New Hampshire because of business taxes and interest and dividends tax returns. And when they looked at those numbers, they said, well, we can bump up the revenues. And they bumped them up about $118 million over the house.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of money. And that's not the only thing that they bumped up. They also said the house figures that we're going to have this amount of money at the end of the 2015 fiscal year and the end of June, we think it's $30 million more than that. So they're not really talking about $118 million. They're talking more close to $150 million that they were able to put back into the budget that the House had taken out from what Governor Maggie Hassan had proposed. So that's why they had they could be the good guys and put the money back into the social programs and the Renewable Energy Fund and all this stuff that went on this week.
So, Kathleen, who was a little happier by the end of the week this week in terms of people, you know, making their cases before the State House?
Oh, I think a lot of people were a little bit happier. The developmental disabilities community, that was a major cut in the House budget. I think in total it was somewhere around $54 million. The Senate was able to restore most of that money. They didn't quite hit 54, but they said that the amount they put in, they were told by the HHS commissioner that would be enough to adequately fund these services. And that was a big worry. We saw a lot of protests about some of those cuts in the House budget. We also saw them put back money for Meals on Wheels, for ServiceLink, programs for seniors that were, in jeopardy and I think had a lot of people very worried. Higher education, they were able to bump UNH up to, or the university system up to $82 million a year. Still, this year they get $84 million, so still a little bit less, but certainly more than what the House had proposed. They gave the community college system back a little bit of money so that they can freeze their tuition. You know, they put most of the money back in the Renewable Energy Fund, although then they did this kind of they went back and they took another $2 million out of it for something else after, you know, patting themselves on the back for restoring all of it. So that was a little interesting, but they were able to put most of that back. They put money back in the Rainy Day Fund. So they did all kinds of stuff. Smaller items. They gave money, the $3.7 million back for tourism promotion that was causing quite a bit of outcry. So they were able to put a lot of things back. But again, as Gary said, they had a whole lot more money to work with. So it becomes easier for them to restore some of these programs.
So what happens next then is the Senate will vote on its budget. It'll get together with the House. They'll get together with the governor. That's basically how it works out, Gary, right?
And I mean, what if you look down the road, I mean, obviously the Senate hasn't even passed it yet. They'll be voting on it the first week of June. But I don't think that's an issue. I think that'll pass fairly quick, easily. But the problem that we're going to be facing here is this is not a budget that's going to pass the House with the same coalition that passed the budget to the Senate. I mean, that coalition included a lot of the people of Bill O'Brien's followers. And this budget is not going to get their vote.
They're going to think it's too much.
So we're going to have a lot of fun when it comes time to try to figure out how we're going to get a budget. I mean, I'm hearing people saying we're probably going to take two or three different votes on through two or three different programs, budget proposals before we finally get something. I mean, everyone is saying don't make plans for July. Now they're saying don't make plans for August either.
Oh, come on. Really?
It always
seems like the warm weather somehow entices people
but
to finish it up.
It's going to be a real problem in the House.
Interesting. All right. Well, you heard it here first.
Because Democrats aren't really going to – they're not going to be quick to jump on this budget because it doesn't have Medicaid expansion in it.
Well, and let's talk about that. Go ahead. Kathleen, you look like you want to jump in, and then I want to ask you about Medicaid.
Yeah, that's the point I was going to make, how you're going to struggle to get Democrats on board with this because there is no money to continue Medicaid expansion. So I think the governor's budget included about $12 million in the second year of the budget to continue this program because federal funding is set to drop a little bit below 100%. Democrats really want this in the budget. Right now, the program is set to sunset at the end of 2016. But Republican senators they're not putting this money back in the budget. And what they're saying is we don't necessarily want to end the program. We're not saying right now we're going to end the program, but we want to debate this next year when we have a fuller picture of how this has been working. And we don't want to debate it now. So it's, you know, Democrats. We saw this fight on the Senate floor yesterday. They fought over reauthorizing Medicaid expansion in the Senate. It's an argument they've had again and again, but Democrats are really trying to make this point that this is something that they want to vote now to continue. They don't want the uncertainty for providers, for the 40,000 people that now have insurance through the program. And you're hearing a lot of Republicans say, Republican senators at least, hey, we think that this program is working. You know, we're glad that people have this health insurance, but we need more actual data to show us the benefits of this program, to see if it's something we want to continue, and we want to have that debate separate of the budget. So will Democrats vote for a budget that doesn't include it? Will the governor sign a budget that doesn't include it? Those are all still questions that we don't really have an answer to.
Interesting. So should it be part of the budget or not? Democrats are saying, let's put it in. Republicans are saying, no, let's talk about it later as a separate policy matter. Did you want to jump in, Kathleen, and then go ahead?
Oh, I was just going to say that the other issue is if they do just vote on it next year, they're going to have, you know, a bill that they've not included in the budget. They're going to have,
so
you know, 10, 12, 14 million bucks that they didn't put in the budget.
And I think there's a real problem with the House next year, too. If you do that, the House is problematic for approving something like that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that, you know, we'll see what happens. I remember what an ordeal it was for Governor Hassan to get this passed initially. She had the special session in November. Nothing came out of that. They finally cut a deal in the January of the following year. You know, the ideological arguments coming out of the Senate, it doesn't have a big ideological feel to it the way it does in the House. They're basically saying, let's wait and see how it's doing next year. You know, these kinds of programs are very hard to undo once you have tens of thousands of people enrolled into them, and I think that will work in the Democrats' favor. So, I mean, I could foresee a budget going forward without that in it, depending on what kind of guarantees there are or agreements about, you know, what happens the year after. I think Gary's point about the House is really interesting, because if you remember back when we had this big debate among Republicans over the Speaker of the House, Sean Jasser's argument was, well, when push comes to shove, we're all going to be on the same side of the issue once we start voting on things. We finally may get to see that fissure cracking wide open that we talked about back when they were debating the speakership, because that's what happened initially in the House, but there's no guarantee, as Gary suggested, that that's going to happen again.
All right. Again, the number here in the exchange, the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about some of the top stories of the week. We talked earlier about Frank Ginta's troubles, the congressman from the 1st District. We're now looking at the state Senate, what it's been doing to the state budget. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email exchange@nhpr.org, and find us on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like. A couple comments on Facebook, guys, about rail. That's another area where the House and Senate agreed. They said no to the $4 million to study further the impact of bringing commuter rail service from Boston to New Hampshire. Aaron says, I would rather we skip the study and just did it. But yes, let's get on with it. Michael says, yes, this is a necessity if New Hampshire wants to stop the outflow of young people and remain economically competitive in the 21st century. So those are a couple comments on rail on our Facebook page. Dean Spiliotis, yeah. $4 million, not a lot of money, but the Senate has made a clear statement.
Well, and it sets the state up for receiving a lot of additional federal matching funds once this thing gets underway. You know, we've talked about rail a number of times in the last few years here, and I've said before, it amazes me the extent to which rail projects around the country have become kind of an ideological litmus test for conservatives who just do not like rail for a variety of reasons, dealing with personal liberty, you know, sort of big government involvement in how people run their lives and commute. So I'm not surprised to see this happen. You know, we'll see what happens in the future. But again, it continues to be a sticking point for Republicans. They just don't like the concept of rail. You know, some business Republicans down in the Nashua area, this is the, you know, particularly the line will kind of come up through Lowell and go to Nashua and maybe Manchester, probably not Concord. So there's some Republicans, you know, on business grounds have made an argument that this would be a good thing for that part of the state. But I'm not surprised to see this happen in the legislature.
Well, so $4 million, and again, it's a fair chunk for a tight state budget like this. But I guess what I was trying to say, Dean, is $4 million compared to what they would get from the feds if they did this.
And somebody floated a figure of, is it $50 million or $55 million? It's a significant chunk of change.
Yeah. You know what I don't get, Kathleen, is, and this relates to Aaron's Facebook comment, I would rather we skip the study, she says. Why do we need to keep studying this thing? It seems like rail's been studied to death.
Yeah, so I'm pretty sure what this money would go for is like an environmental and engineering study. So actually starting to practically look at, you know, how where this project would go, how exactly we would go about getting it up and running. So I don't think it was to continue studying like how many people would ride it and how much whether it's a good idea or not, but actually practically how it would happen. And
those studies have been done already.
Yeah, and the interesting debate in the Senate Capital Budget Committee yesterday is. The Republican senators weren't necessarily striking an ideological tone, but they were saying that they were not really buying the economic development figures. They didn't think that this was going to bring in the kind of development that the study alleges it would. And also, they're worried about the level to which the state would have to subsidize it going forward.
Yeah, but that's the first layer of this deeper ideological argument about federal subsidies and government involvement. Yeah.
Right. I just think that they were talking about it on a very, I think, practical budget level, but they weren't really getting into the idea of, if you subsidize it for $10 million, ultimately, how much does that bring back in economic development money? So, they rejected it. And I don't know what it means for the project going forward, if there's another way to get this going. But it's certainly not going to be in the budget.
Well, real quick, Gary Reno, the Josiah Bartlett Center came out with its own study on this a couple weeks back, I think, or just a week or two ago, saying it's not an economic benefit for New Hampshire.
Well, and they did. I mean, and I think it's like anything else. You can kind of play it either way you want. You can determine the results you want when you go in. But, it is a kind of a crapshoot. But it certainly does have a lot of support among the business community in both Nashua and Manchester, and a lot of Republican support above that community.
Well, here's an email from Maureen on a topic that I did want to ask you folks about. Maureen says she wants to talk about the election of Yvonne Dean Bailey, a 19-year-old college student, to the New Hampshire House. That was a special election this week. Maureen says, as the youngest woman to have been elected to the New Hampshire House of Representatives, I believe it is important for young people to be represented in our citizen legislature. She says, young lawmakers can bring new ideas, a fresh perspective to the role of government in our great state. I served for 6 years and felt welcome to the table to voice my ideas about the role of government from the viewpoint of a young woman and a college student. Maureen says, my service in the New Hampshire House remains one of the highlights of my life, one that I look back on with great pride and warm memories. Maureen, thank you. That's great to hear from her. So this has to do with the 19-year-old woman who got elected this week, Yvonne Dean Bailey, Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, this was in District 32. This is a floterial district, so it's made up of a number of towns, Candia, Deerfield, Northwood, and Nottingham. It was a close election. She won by 126 votes. They had about 2,600 people voting, which is considered good turnout for a special election there. She's quite conservative. She's a student at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. She's now transferring to UNH. I mean, one of the interesting things about our state legislature is you often see fairly young adults getting in. It's really an opportunity for grassroots involvement. This particular election got some additional attention because a former volunteer of the Democratic candidate, Maureen Mann, sent out an email. He created a fake email account and sent out an email saying that Yvonne Dean Bailey had withdrawn from the race, and it created all kinds of a furor. But in the end, it turned out, if nothing else, maybe it brought additional attention to the race for her, and she ended up taking the seat.
Well, and real quick, Gary, to you, the seat was vacated in the first place because?
Because of Brian Dobson, who held the seat. He resigned to take a job with Frank Ginta. He may wish he wanted to hold on to that $100.
Yeah, and I just want to quickly add, I think that the emailer brings up a good point that, there are young people in our legislature, but
yeah, we always talk about how old the legislature is.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, if you just kind of look around the room, you're going to see probably a lot more gray hair than not. And that's no offense to anyone serving in the legislature. But we talk a lot about or the lawmakers talk a lot about wanting to bring young people to the state of New Hampshire, wanting to attract young people. How do we do that? And I think it is important, to have some of these younger voices in. And, in the Democratic Party, there are a couple college age students. There are a few other Republicans that are in college. And it is interesting to have those voices, I think, as part of the debate as we continue to talk about bringing young people here.
All right. Well, Maureen, thank you again. It's great to hear about your experiences. Thanks for chiming in on this story. I did want to turn to another story that NHPR's health reporter Jack Rodolico has been covering very closely. That's the Lakeview Rehabilitation Center. This is an 88-bed residential facility in Effingham that cares for individuals with physical, neurological, cognitive, and behavioral impairments. The facility this week announced it's shutting down. Jack's been covering this closer probably than anybody in the state, Jack. Why are they shutting down?
So what happened this week is that they've been under really intense scrutiny since last September from the governor's office, the Department of Health and Human Services in particular, and that initiated a process with the Department of Education because Lakeview has this treatment facility that's residential with people from all over the country, but they also have a special ed school that's licensed by the Department of Education. So DOE had been coming in and doing inspections and finding a very long list of deficiencies, and ultimately they pulled their license last month. Now, they had a chance, Lakeview had a chance to do an appeal, and they did that appeal in front of the Board of Education this week. It was kind of like a trial. I was there, and it was, you know, lawyers from one side, lawyers from the other. And ultimately, the board voted unanimously, 6-0, to back the state up and pull that license. Now, that doesn't shut the facility down. It shuts the school down. But what the CEO told me was that between the state's ban on new admissions and the subtext to that that he wasn't talking about is the fact that states are pulling their residents. They have been pulling their residents for months, so the revenue is dwindling. And the fact that they now don't have a school, it really undercuts the viability of the program. So what they're saying is he says that it's possible they could sell. There are a number of other companies actually that have already been stepping into this space as Lakeview has been winding down operations. Two other companies have been moving in and taking on some of their clients. I don't know that anybody would be capable of buying that particular facility. I'm talking more about group homes. This is an 80-bed facility for people with really high complex needs. So one scenario could be that that place gets bought. I can't predict if that's going to happen or not. The other scenario is that we've now got 60 individuals who are all extremely vulnerable, who wound up at Lakeview because their families could not find another placement for them. This includes somebody from Hawaii, somebody from Oregon, people from all over the country. And so now, you know, these states, New Hampshire is communicating with those states, with those parents, and people need to find other placements.
Well, and Patty wrote a comment on our Facebook page, Jack, about this. She says, sounds like it needed to happen. So very scary for the residents and families. How could this happen? And I'll direct you, Patty, to Jack's extensive reporting on this at nhpr.org. Under the series tab. But she also asks, where will the residents be placed? Sounds like we don't know.
We don't know. So let's think about it. Let's break it into two components. About a dozen of those residents, a quarter of them are New Hampshire residents. They'll likely wind up in New Hampshire at group homes. You know, there's Crotchet Mountain, Easter Seals, there's Neuro Restorative, there's now Beckett Academy. These are all companies that take care of people like this and have clinicians. And so fingers crossed that they find a good placement close to home. Everybody else, it's going to be up to families and their states to find another placement, maybe back home in their other state or someplace else around the country. It's very uncertain.
Well, it's tough. And Jack, you've done a great deal of reporting on this. Thank you very much for jumping in with us today.
Good to be here.
You can find all of Jack Rodolico's reporting on abuse and neglect at Lakeview under the series tab at nhpr.org. More Friday New Hampshire News Roundup in just a moment. This is the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. In this section of the Roundup, we'll look at presidential primary contenders, where they were, what they said. Let's hear from you, too. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. 1-800-892-6477, again, is the number. And Dean Spiliotis, so first of all, just give us the rundown. Who was here this week?
It's been a busy week, as it seems every week has been a busy
for
week,
sure.
Particularly on the Republican side. Well, we had Chris Christie stopping off in Portsmouth, Lincoln Chafee, former governor of Rhode Island, used to be a Republican, now a Democrat, thinking of running for the Democratic nomination. He was in Concord. Ben Carson, a retired pediatric neurosurgeon, was in Derry. And among others, Hillary Clinton is here today on the seacoast visiting Smutty Nose Brewing Company and having a party, an organizing party with supporters in Exeter. So a busy week, as we seem to have every week now.
And you mentioned Lincoln
Chafee. Jeb Bush, I forgot to mention
as
well. Sorry.
Jeb
Bush was here as well talking with voters. Yeah, it's important to remember.
Yep, talking about a lot of good, you know, solid policy subjects, education.
Yeah, and trying to dig himself out from a very bad week on Iraq last week.
So Lincoln Chafee, another possible Democratic contender?
Yeah, you know, he certainly in the mix, says he's 95% likely that he's going to run. He was a Republican in Congress for many years, has had about, I think, like a 30-year career at least. Eventually switched from the Republican Party, I think, to an independent. Now he's a Democrat. Was the governor of Rhode Island, I think, for one term, left with very low popularity. In terms of going after Hillary Clinton, which he has already started to do, he was the only Republican to vote against the Iraq war resolution in 2002 or 2003. And so he's already going after Hillary Clinton for that. Also kind of raising some questions about ethical standards and the emails and the Clinton cash to the Global Initiative, et cetera. So he'll be in the mix. You know, it's going to be a huge uphill battle for him, to say the least. But again, you know, we typically think of the Democratic race in terms of, you know, the pressures that these various potential candidates like a Lincoln Chafee or a Martin O'Malley or Bernie Sanders or even a Jim Webb from Virginia, like what would be the impact of them in terms of pressuring Hillary Clinton? That's still what the narrative is, and I think it's going to be that way for the foreseeable future.
Who caught your attention this week, Gary Reno? As Dean said, there were a lot of people here.
Well, I think Governor Christie did for some reason. I mean, he seems to be out there trying to reclaim the middle ground. There's a lot of room in the middle ground and for all the Republican candidates out there, and particularly over the Patriot Act. He was out there defending the Patriot Act, saying, hey, I was next door. I know what this is all about.
Sure. New Jersey, New York, 9/11.
And I thought that was very interesting. Well, the rest of the candidates running for president have been dumping all over the Patriot Act. He's standing behind it and saying, hey, this is what I believe.
That is interesting.
And I think it's basically him trying to reclaim that middle ground in the Republican Party.
Well, and in light of Rand Paul, right, the Kentucky senator.
He went on a filibuster for about 10 or 11 hours in the Senate this week over the Patriot Act.
Yeah, Christie didn't get the campaign memo on New Hampshire's libertarian leaning.
So no, he didn't.
Said the security, surveillance and security issues of the Patriot Act are overblown, and it's just not the ideal way to situate. But if that's really what he believes, he has to kind of go forward with that.
Well, that's his whole theme,
yes.
Right?
That's the risk, campaign.
Yeah, go ahead, Kathy.
Yeah, I think at one point he also said that the government is the U.S. government is not the enemy, and I think that that's a message that some in New Hampshire probably don't like very much, the more libertarian-leaning people who, see the government very much as the enemy. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how this debate plays out in the Republican primary, because you really have two sides. I think Ted Cruz, I think, is also against the Patriot Act. And then I'm not sure where, Marco Rubio, Jeb Bush are on it. But I think that it's going to be a pretty, substantial policy debate among the Republican primary voters, people who are trying to capture the more hawkish, national security leaning voters like Chris Christie's trying to do versus the people who want the more libertarian minded voters. And it's, an important debate. And I think one that a lot of Americans, can relate to their lives in a very real way when they think about, surveillance. We had Chris Christie coming out and saying Edward Snowden's a criminal. And I think that's still a name that people know and the jury's still out on. So very interesting. I also think it's kind of fun to watch how these candidates approach the primary. We have Chris Christie. It's all he's making major policy speeches in New Hampshire. This is his third one now. He did, entitlement reform, foreign policy, and one other that I can't remember.
So meaty stuff.
Meaty stuff, and he's also doing these big town halls that tell it like it is. He really, really wants that back and forth. He wants to engage with the voters. That's kind of his shtick. Jeb Bush, on the other hand, a little bit more controlled. He's going to house parties, to business roundtables. He is opening himself up a little bit to the back and forth. He did a meeting with some of the House Business Caucus, so state representatives. They had a chance to go in and ask him questions over at the draft in Concord. Hillary Clinton, much, much more structured than either of them. She's coming in and she's doing these very structured roundtable events. If she's going to house parties, they're house parties with supporters, definitely some undecided people, but definitely friendly audiences. So it's interesting to see how they all kind of react to the voters and how they are approaching this primary process right now. And everybody has a little bit of a different approach.
Yeah, it is really interesting to see. Some people, you're right, Kathleen, are getting out there and just talking to everybody, and other people are doing it in a more careful style. And Dean, to you, Hillary Clinton has come under criticism from national media, from Republicans, even some Democrats, for being so careful. What's the benefit of doing it that way. She seems to be getting hit on that a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, I think if they had their druthers, they would have preferred to just put the whole thing off until sometime in the summer. I mean, I think they know that they're in a very strong position in the Democratic primary, yet they've kind of had to contend with this national media narrative that she's hiding from the press and not answering questions. I believe one of the networks, it might have been Fox, but I'm not sure, had a countdown clock on how long it had been since the last time she took a question from a reporter. I think sort of average voters are not really paying attention to all that. That's kind of insider baseball. But nonetheless, I mean, so, you know, she had all this pressure to get into the race. She got into the race, and now they basically are pretty much lying low. I mean, she is back. They've announced, I think, that she is going to do some big rally in the near future, finally, if not in New Hampshire, somewhere else. I can't recall where she's going to do it. But, you know, they're trying to sort of kind of control her exposure as best as possible. You know, we all know there are times where that's useful and times it can backfire. I don't think she's at sort of the backfiring stage yet. You know, and it's interesting. I think I liked the point about, you know, George Bush, Jeb Bush, who spent a lot of time talking about his brother George. Mm-hmm. You know, I think for him, you know, he's this very kind of sort of laid back, still thinking about running, et cetera, et cetera. You know, at some point needs to get into the race and show that he really wants this. He doesn't really seem like he's really driven to pursue this. And I think that's going to start hurting him if he doesn't sort of start to seem like he's really in this. It's been fascinating to me to see the extent to which candidates now, you know, they don't really have exploratory committees. They say they're kind of possibly thinking about it, even though it seems like they're running. And then, at some point in June, they'll have a rally maybe saying that they're in, or they'll send out a video over the web saying they're in.
Yeah, that is kind of interesting.
It's very different.
And I keep catching myself. I keep saying presidential candidates, but in fact,
some of them are not candidates. Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a strategy. There's part of that is that, you know, these leadership PACs that have now supplanted exploratory committees allow you to raise money, you know, basically unlimited money, and Jeb Bush can do this until you become an official candidate. So I think there's a reason why he's putting it off as well.
I see. It's a financial thing.
Helps. All right. Helps him raise money.
Let's take a call, folks. And Ned is joining us from Concord. Hi, Ned. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Laura. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to comment. I think the comments of your panel are right on in terms of how each of the candidates are approaching the primary, based on their own unique needs and their own unique knowledge of New Hampshire. I realized sort of with a gasp the other day that this is my 12th presidential primary. And when you look at it, it's 9 months away, and there are going to be small meetings with supporters and small meetings with voters and large meetings with both and editorial boards and press conferences. And each campaign will go through that, and they will push all those buttons. But it's 9 months between now and our primary and 18 months before the general election. And I think what you see is the campaigns are shaping their approach to New Hampshire and their approach to the campaign based on the unique positions they come from. Hillary Clinton, this is the fourth time that she's been deeply engaged in a primary in New Hampshire. So she knows our traditions and our expectations and our people and other people we're going first time around are going to take it in different order. And I think it's interesting and also sometimes amusing when everybody who has their own particular perspective either says, well, they haven't talked to me yet, so the clock is ticking. and it's sort of like, you know, everybody has an expectation. There's some that say, well, if you haven't talked to all the senators and all the reps and at least been out to the house to wash the car, you're not taking it seriously. But I think it's tremendously important for us to understand that we're probably the last place in this presidential route where those small meetings are going to be able to take place. I've been involved in a lot of primaries, and when you follow the campaign after New Hampshire, you find it's all tarmac and press conferences and big events.
Sure.
It's not the kind of intimacy that we see in New Hampshire. And I think it's so important for each candidate to seek that in their own way. I'm a big Hillary supporter.
All right.
But I think she's doing it in a way that fits.
Well, and it gets to your point, Kathleen, which is everybody's approaching this the way that works for them. And Ned's point is well taken about, you know, it's still a long ways away. The tactics and approaches could dramatically change from month to month.
Yeah, I think we have to remember that, you know, while all of us in the media and the real junkies are paying a lot of attention, most of the average voters, even people who will become very engaged at this point, are kind of scanning the headlines. You know, they're not necessarily super concerned about when they're going to get a chance to meet Hillary Clinton or some of these other people. They know that there's time. And I think everyone's approach, you know, is definitely going to shift as the process goes forward.
Go ahead, Gary.
And I think to take Ned's point, you know, there are these small meetings and it's the last place. But to be honest with you, there are a lot less small meetings in New Hampshire than there ever used to be. It used to be a much more retail-oriented primary than it is today. Today, it's a lot of media and a lot of advertising, and it's not the one-on-one that it used to be here in New Hampshire.
A couple other headlines I wanted to follow up with you guys. One of them concerns, this is a disturbing story, Gary Reno. The state attorney general's office this week joined with federal law enforcement officials and those from many, many states in a complaint against four cancer charities. Now, who are these groups and what did they do?
Well, they raised at least $187 million that they spent on themselves and their friends instead of actually for cancer patients and treatment, et cetera. The groups are Cancer Fund of America, Cancer Support Services, Children's Cancer Fund of America, and the Breast Cancer Society. What's interesting is the Cancer Fund of America has run afoul in New Hampshire once before in 1991. The AG had a consent decree with them where they ended up returning money to the people who donated, and they also contributed $36,000 to the state and $17,000 to the Norris Cotton Cancer Center. So it seems as though there's a history here.
You know what I don't get, though, Gary? I thought that the AG's offices, you know, here and around the country were supposed to keep an eye on these charities and, you know, make sure that they don't bilk people, well-meaning people who want to help, you know,
right.
cancer
I know,
patients.
But, I mean, if we look at New Hampshire, I mean, there are hundreds of charities registered in this state. And we have like a very small consumer protection division, which, I mean, they can look at some of the people that they want, but their chances of catching something like this, which is a national organization, basically, is pretty minuscule.
Well, last quick question for you on this, Gary. So what does it mean that New Hampshire is getting involved in this complaint? Does that mean litigation? Does that mean possible money?
I think it is a settlement coming down the road, that's for sure, and trying to get some money back for the people in New Hampshire who contributed to these four organizations.
Okay, so Dean Spiliotis, some good news this week from the state. New Hampshire's unemployment rate for April, 3.8%. Wow.
That's right. And this time, or actually, the April numbers for last year were 4.5%. So we've dropped over the past year. Nationally, this April, the national employment rate was 5.4%. So we continue to perform better than the national rate. You know, there's always a lot of, particularly in election season, a lot of debate about these numbers and how solid they are. I know whenever good numbers come out, I spend a few minutes listening to conservative talk radio to see the reaction. And usually they say, well, we'll see. These numbers are often adjusted upwards after they're out of the press for a month because they do get kind of revisited a month later. And in addition, a lot of talk about, well, this is doesn't account for people who have dropped out of the labor force, et cetera. But I think there's, you know, no denying that things have improved at some level. There's increasing upward pressure on wages, which is, you know, people have been waiting to see if wages were going to bump up. We're seeing a number of corporations around the country start to bump up their minimum wages as well. So this feeds into the larger political debate in November, November of 16, but in the primary, certainly, about whether or not the economy is it really improving. Are wages going to finally catch up? And are people who are people discouraged from actually looking for jobs rather than the actual unemployment rate dropping?
All right. One more story. Speaking of employment, this week, Fairpoint Communications announced big layoffs in northern New England. More than 200 people in New Hampshire, Maine, and Vermont. Anybody want to comment on why the continuing problems at Fairpoint? Gary?
I think the continuing problems at Fairpoint is what's happening in the telecommunications industry. People are dropping landlines, and they're largely a landline company. And the more people cancel their landlines, the more they're going to have problems financially.
Yeah, and they provide internet.
And they provide
connection
internet,
too, though.
But, I mean, the real problem is the landlines. That's the bread and butter here. And, I mean, they just had a 4-month-long strike that got settled. And you know, this was probably the other shoe that was going to drop once it got settled.
All right. Well, Kathleen, it's Memorial Day weekend, so I hope you're not working too hard next week. But what are you going to be covering?
I'm going to continue to follow the Senate budget process. They have, I think, Tuesday and Wednesday next week. They're going to be finalizing their plan. So everything that, you know, we just talked about a little bit earlier on the show is still subject to change. We never know what's going to happen. I think we're going to see numbers that show us how this thing is balancing next week, because we didn't mention earlier, but we haven't yet seen the full spending numbers, so we don't exactly know how this is balancing, so we'll continue to follow that next week.
Okay, and just remind us, so they have to vote by early June, right?
So the Senate Finance Committee will finalize the budget next week, and the week after that, the full chamber will vote,
okay.
June 4th.
And we'll talk about it on future roundups, I'm sure. Gary Rayner, real quick, what are you covering?
Senate budget, too. Also, there's a bill out there about starting felony cases in Superior Court as opposed to district court. That's still waiting out there. And workman's comp reform is also going to be decided in the next week or so.
Oh, big issue. We did a whole show on that. Okay. And Dean, how about you?
You know, for the next month, it's going to be the same thing each week. State budget and presidential visits.
Okay. Fun stuff for a political observer.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much. All of you, thank you for being here. Have a great, great long weekend. Gary Rayner, good to see you.
Good to see you, Laura.
Gary Rayner, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Kathleen, thanks for giving us your time.
Thanks, Laura.
Kathleen Ronayne, New Hampshire State House and Politics reporter with the Associated Press. Last but not least, Dean Spiliotis, thank you for being here.
Sure thing. Thanks, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. This is The Exchange on NHPR.